Hey folks, welcome to The Other People Show. I'm Brad Listy here in Los Angeles, California. It's nice to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. Hope you're doing okay. Today is Friday, so it's time for a flashback episode. I'm going to dig into the Other People archives and share an outtake from an episode out of the past. Today's flashback features an outtake from episode 666, my conversation with author Stephen Graham Jones. It first aired on August 16th, 2020. Stephen Graham Jones is the best-selling author of The Only Good Indians and My Heart is a Chainsaw, among other books. He has been the recipient of several literary awards, including the Ray Bradbury Award from the Los Angeles Times, the Bram Stoker Award, the Shirley Jackson Award, just to name a few. Stephen Graham Jones is a professor of English at the University of Colorado in Boulder. You'll hear an outtake from episode 666 momentarily. Don't forget to subscribe to The Other People Show wherever you listen. You can also subscribe on YouTube. Follow the show on social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. I would love it if you signed up for my weekly email newsletter. You can do that over at bradlisty.substack.com. It is free. I would love it even more if you joined The Other People Patreon community over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Help keep this show going into the future. So today's flashback once again comes from episode 666. It first aired on August 16th, 2020, a reminder that the full conversation with Stephen Graham Jones is available in the feed. So if you like what you hear in this flashback and you want to go in for the full hour, just look for episode 666. It is there, as are all episodes of this show. All right? I think that's it. Here I am back in 2020, talking with Stephen Graham Jones.
I read my first Stephen King. That was Tommyknocker. Stayed up all night reading it. Terrified me to no end. I still love that novel. Dove into the rest of Stephen King, discovered Dean Koontz, Clive Barker, everybody else, you know, in the 80s and early 90s. Just kept going. And then I think my third novel, Demon Theory, is horror. And, you know, my first novel, it's not listed as horror, but it's got giant coyotes eating people and all kinds of weird stuff going on. So horror is just in my veins. I'm hardwired for horror, I feel like.
Why? Do you know why?
Why me specifically? I ascribe it to when I was in eighth grade. We were living outside Austin, Texas, a little place called Wimberley. And I got to run in with a group of other eighth graders who had a friend at the video store. And every Friday afternoon after school, that we would go in to the video store and come away with a stack of six or eight, you know, Jason, Freddy, Michael. And we'd go to my other friend's garage, which was out in the woods, separate from his house. And there was a TV in there and a little couch and a VCR. And we just watched slasher after slasher. And come about 2 in the morning, my friend's dad would get drunk enough to put on his Freddy glove and come scratch his plastic claws down the outside of that metal garage door. And that would just terrify us to no end. We would just pile out the side of that garage, that side door, and run through the blackness of the night. And if we made it to the creek and jumped in, we were safe. I don't know why that was a rule, but that was the rule. And that feeling of running through the blackness with tears going back from my eyes, terrified and also smiling at the same time, I feel like that is what I'm always looking for when I read and when I write horror. And that's kind of what, just that thrill, that being so alive is what I like about horror.
Oh, that's interesting. It's interesting to think of it that way. I mean, I feel like when we go to read something, we're trying to feel something, or hoping to at least. And if somebody if somebody can scare the shit out of you, that's a, you know, that's a feeling.
It is. Horror can change your behavior. It can make you turn off the lights in your house in a different sequence at 11 o'clock at night. It can make you edge along the wall to get to your bed instead of just walking brazenly across the middle of the bedroom floor. You know, and that I love that horror puts you on a string like that. It turns you into a puppet of not necessarily the writer, but a puppet of your own terror, you know, your own dread. I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I guess this is like the common question for writers of horror is their relationship to fear and whether writing horror diminishes fear, you know, and the role that it plays in their day-to-day lives. Like, do you have a healthier relationship with it as a result of writing in this way? Or do you feel like you have maybe like a, like just a, like a heightened sense of terror and this is your way of exercising it?
I think it's the second one. I always have the idea that if I can trap this nightmare that I had 3 nights ago or for 6 nights in a row or however it is, if I can trap it on the page in a way that I can pass it on to someone else, like that videotape in The Ring, that I'll no longer be burdened with it. I'll no longer be infected with it. But really all that ever happens is it gives my terrors and my nightmares like higher delineation, you know, it gives them more resolution. And so I'm more scared. I know a lot of horror writers and horror filmmakers as well, because they know the mechanics of a scare, they have a harder time themselves being scared. That's not the case for me. I do understand the mechanics of a scare. It's just the mechanics of a joke, basically. But I get terrified when I'm writing horror. People always say that, how do you write so fast or why do you write so fast? And the reason I write so fast is because I'm terrified. Because to me, writing a novel or a story is being in a dark, terrifying tunnel, and I'm just racing as fast as I can to get that light at the other end because I am terrified.
And so how fast do you write?
I used to do the 3-day novel contest, so I mean I could probably still do a novel in 3 days if I had to. You know, these days give me about 4 to 6 weeks and I can kick out a novel pretty well.
And it's publishable?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's publishable. My editor sometimes thinks it needs a lot more work, and I put the more work into it, of course. But yeah, I can get the first draft down in 4 to 6 weeks. And you know, I'm a big believer in you write your first draft with your heart, and then you come back and revise with your brain. You know, so you've got to do whatever you can in that first draft to shut down your critical faculties so you can accidentally do something good. If you think too much, you're always going to be second-guessing yourself. You're always going to be trying to position this text in relation to an audience or history or the ages or the critics or any of that. And you can't be worried about that. You just got to rush through without any thought with a lot of heart and hopefully a lot of blood.
So how does it look? Are you writing on a word count basis, or do you just sit down at a certain time and work for that period? Or like, what is the actual process look like?
It's usually not a word count. I do tend to keep a word count up on my screen. I use Pages, but I don't try to ring like a 1200 word bell or a 5000 word bell or anything like that. And I don't do Pages either. I try to move more in story units, and that'll often take the shape of a chapter or a scene in a chapter if it's a long chapter. And once I get to the end of that, and then I feel like I've earned, like my carrot is that section break or that chapter break, and I can go outside and work on my truck or go play hacky sack or do whatever. You know, I can do other stuff. It's not that it's not that writing is not what I want to be doing. To me, writing is playing with dragons. It's the best thing ever. But you have to do things with your body, with your hands. You can't just do the mind all the time, or I think you get lost in your own mind.
Yeah, no, I think there has to be some kind of counterpoint. Like, I like to hike. I feel like that's part of writing for me. You know, I know a lot of writers.
Yeah.
I know a lot of writers who, I ride my bike a lot too, or, you know, there are writers who like to run, but I don't understand. The writers that mystify me are the ones who like literally just sit at home and just read and write. That's all they do.
And yeah, that Emily Dickinson lifestyle of, you know, shutting yourself in your attic and just writing and wishing evil on people or whatever it is you do when you're in the attic. I can't imagine that either. I mean, in this shutdown times, we all kind of are in some version of an attic, of course, with our word processors. But like, I ride my bike as well. I spend at least 2 hours every day banging up and down the trails. You know, if I'm not out there, then I go crazy. I get too jittery to be able to write anymore if I don't go burn some energy.
So I want to ask you, you said something earlier that I feel like listeners at home might be wondering about, which is the mechanics of a scare and the similarity they have to the mechanics of a joke. Like, what are the mechanics of a scare? Is it really something you can boil down into some fundamentals?
You know, it's about lulls, I think. It's about first you establish what's normal, and then you give the reader the intimation that there's something in the darkness. You give them a rustle out there in the leaves or whatever, but you don't deliver that immediately. You have the character who is, you know, victim to that scare be like Ripley on Alien and on the Nostromo when she's looking for the xenomorph. You know, she's going through all this, all these tunnels of pipes and everything, and she rounds a corner and that's not the alien. She rounds a corner and that's not the alien. So the tension ratchets up higher and higher. And somewhere along there, you usually release that tension with a bit of humor, with a cat jumping out or something ridiculous like that. And that allows the tension to reset. And then it's like you've got your foot on a pump. You pump it back up slowly with each step, with each look into the darkness, and then you deliver something. I think the mechanics of a scare is that, or maybe it's just the ingredients. Maybe I should say ingredients. I think it's 80-85% dread with a spike of terror at the end. Like, dread is sitting on your couch staring at your front door waiting for someone to knock, waiting for something to knock. Terror is opening the door and seeing who just knocked. And as a fiction writer, you have to put your reader on that couch staring at the door for the majority of the time.
What about pacing? You know, I feel like you're talking a bit about this as you speak about sequencing and the build, but you know, in literary fiction, I was just having a conversation not too long ago on this show with a writer, and we were talking about writing about personal pain and how you're supposed to slow down where it hurts, which is a little bit counterintuitive. It's hard writing, but it's good for the reader. You know, a lot of times I think the impulse is to rush through the painful parts. When it comes to delivering like a really authentic, like visceral scare on the page, does the principle apply? Like, is slowing down when things get really intense the way to go?
I think it is. I think of it less as slowing down and more about dilating the moment. The same way, like, you know, I read about an experiment they did in a lab where they showed people flashcards on a video screen, and they had them write down which of them they could remember in what sequence. And then they put them on the edge of like a ball pit or something, or a foam pit. And as they were falling back into the foam pit, they showed them a different series of flashcards on the video screen. And then afterwards had them write down what they remembered. And they remembered so much better as they were falling than as they were just sitting in a chair. And it's because in these times of intensity, our mind clicks up and goes faster and faster. And I think it's trying to take like snapshots of every slice of an instant. And so in horror, there's a lot of intense moments like that. And so I think we have to slow down for those moments and process the moral revulsion, the visceral revulsion, process the sensory input. We have to do all that and not do it like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, they have to be textured together in like this big ball of yuck that you throw at the reader's face.
What about living in these times? I mean, again, this I think is probably a question that is commonly posed to writers of horror, you know, nowadays, but we're kind of living through a nightmare. I think we're living through a nightmare with the pandemic and with all that it entails. And I think we're living through a nightmare with this presidency. That's just my opinion, but I think it's widely shared. There's a lot of stuff that's actually happening in the world that, you know, would qualify, especially in years past, as the stuff of horror fiction, and now it's our reality. Like, how does that change your relationship to the work that you do? Like, how do you process this as somebody who, you know, lives in this kind of imaginary realm on a day to day?
You know, my imaginary realm I live in on the page has always been a retreat from the real world. Like on the page for 25 pages at a time or for 400 pages at a time, I can engage a world that makes sense, a world that where you pull this, that happens, or a world where this misdeed occurs and it's punished, you know, 3 months later or 10 years later or whatever it is. On the page, the world makes sense. The real world to me has never made any sense. I can go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and order, you know, crispy chicken, and they give me grilled chicken, and I cannot imagine the chain of events that led to me getting grilled chicken when I wanted crispy chicken. And on the page, I can explain it. I can't explain the real world. The real world doesn't make sense to me. And so the way that this, you know, nightmare we're living through has affected me, I think, is that I'm just like burrowing deeper into my imaginary safe place, I guess. I mean, I'm not saying that's a noble thing. I should be out trying to change the world, you know, but being an artist, all I've got's my art, or that's what I feel like I've only got anyways. So I write books, I write stories, and I do try to push back against the world. I don't know if I necessarily offer a corrective or any kind of prescription or anything, but I do try to call out the things that I see are wrong anyways.
How many books have you written in quarantine? Like 6 books now? What?
Man, since quarantine, oh, I don't know. It's March. Since March. This would be since March. Yeah. You know, I don't think I've written any. I've been doing revisions and scripts since March mostly. And, you know, versions and versions and layers of scripts because, you know, studios and executives always want redos. But,
you're a screenwriter as well?
I'm starting to mess with that, yes. Oh. And it's fun, and I'm doing comic books too, and I just had to do a big revision on a comic book I've got coming out, and it's weird. I hadn't thought about that. I think I wrote 3 novels last year, maybe 4. And this year, no, I'm lying. I started a novel in December, and then I finished it in February. So right before the pandemic started, I finished a novel, so I kind of wrote one this year, I guess.
So how much caffeine do you drink? Any?
Oh, this might. I drink a lot. I don't drink coffee. I can't even. I found the worst thing about being a writer for me, anyways, is that people always want to interview me at coffee shops, and I have these like swimmy headed interview experiences because the smell of coffee just repulses me. I always try to sit outside if I can at a coffee shop, and I will drink tea, and I love caffeine drinks. And I have caffeine pills and I have caffeine gum. I love caffeine.
Well, I'm just like, okay, this is making me feel better. For somebody who's writing 3 and 4 books in a year, I'm like, there's got to be some kind of amphetamine happening.
Yeah. It used to be candy and vanilla Coke, but I finally decided that's not really a healthy way to live, you know? So I have the idea that like pure caffeine is healthier. And I'm sure like, I'll be like Philip K. Dick and start seeing the pink lights at some point here. You know?
I think Philip K. Dick was doing more than caffeine.
Yes, I think so.
So what's an example? I mean, you've touched on some authors already in conversation that inspired you, but what is an example in your view of the perfect horror novel or one that comes close?
You know, I think the most perfect horror novel I've read lately is going to be Gemma Files' experimental film. She's out of Canada. I think Cheezing put this out maybe 3-4 years ago, something like that. And that novel is about some filmmakers who, as we all move into like a more digital rather than an analog age or space, they discover that there's terrifying possibilities in old film anyways. And it's that novel just terrifies me. I bet I've read that novel 5 or 6 times now. And just as far as structuring and pacing and everything and stakes, that novel just does it all to me. I love that novel. I love teaching that novel too. I've never taught it and had students not fall in love with it. As for like going back further, I think The Shining might be one of the most perfect horror novels because at the end of it, it does that necessary thing that so many books, movies, stories don't do, where what's his name?
Jack or
no, Dick. What's his name? Halloran. Dick Halloran.
Right.
He at the end has a moment of hesitation where he can walk around the edge of the shed and be kind of a minion of the presence in The Shining and dispatch Danny Torres, you know, and I love that after the horror is over, it's not really over. I mean, I know we all expect, we in a slasher, you knock Jason down, the credits roll, and you expect after the credits for his eye to open behind the mask or a finger to move or something. That's like built into the horror genre for sure. But I think Stephen King with Dick Halloran having that moment of indecision at the end of The Shining is one of the strongest examples of that.
All right, there we have it. That is today's flashback.
an outtake from episode 666, my conversation with author Stephen Graham Jones. Episode 666 first aired on August 16th, 2020. A reminder that if you enjoyed this flashback episode and you would like to hear the full conversation with Stephen Graham Jones, just look for episode 666. It is in the feed, available wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to learn more about Stephen Graham Jones, you can track him down on the internet. His website is demontheory.net. He is also on Twitter and, I believe, Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen. You can also subscribe on YouTube. Follow the show on social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you want to sign up for my weekly email newsletter, you can do so at bradlisty.substack.com. It is free, and I would love it if you would join the Other People Patreon community over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Help keep this show going into the future. If you have a couple of minutes and you want to do me a quick favor, please give this show a rating and write a little review wherever you listen. It helps the show find new listeners. If you want to sign up for the Other People Book Club or get some Other People apparel, a t-shirt or a sweatshirt, you can do that at the show's official website, otherppl.com. Finally, I have a book out. My latest book is a novel. It is called Be Brief and Tell Them Everything, available now in trade paperback, ebook, and audiobook editions. I narrate the audiobook, so if you want to read my book, you can do that. It's called Be Brief and Tell Them Everything. So coming up on Sunday, I will be in conversation with Rowan Baird. Her debut novel is called The Divorcees. It is available from Flatiron Books. Had a great talk with Rowan Baird about divorce ranches. That's where her novel is set, in the mid-20th century. Fascinating. And I'm excited to share that one with you in just a couple of days. So stay tuned.